This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
It's boxing.
A look inside boxing with Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Interviews, analysis, and everything going on in boxing. And now a man who I wish was called the Boston Bleeder.
All doctors to the ER.
It's sort of like getting punched in the face.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back. SI Boxing Podcast. On this episode, we have a really good one lined up for you. Keith Idek, senior writer, BoxingScene.com. He joins me. He's back. And we talk about all the news of the week, from Deontay Wilder's decision not to continue training with Mark Breland. You've got the Boxing Hall of Fame ballots going out. Who is going to get left out in a very loaded class? And Eddie Hearn says that Jermall Charlo versus Demetrius Andrade is an easy fight to make. Is it? Oh, man, I want that fight to happen so bad. Get into all that much more with Keith Idek from BoxingScene.com. A little bit later on, Leo Santa Cruz, 130-pound title holder. He has a huge fight coming up against Gervonta Davis. That fight's going to take place on October 31st on Showtime pay-per-view. I talked to Leo about his last fight, which was a little bit underwhelming, why he's targeted Davis, and why he thinks he has what it takes to win a fight this big. All that and more with Leo Santa Cruz. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, easy way you can support it. Get over to Apple Podcast, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, on to my conversation with Keith Idek. All right, Keith Idek is here, senior writer, BoxingScene.com, friend of the program, friend of quarantined events, too. Keith made his ringside debut just a couple of weeks back at the Jermall Charlo, Sergey Derevyanchenko, Jermall Charlo, Jason Rosario card. First, Keith, how was that experience for you?
It wasn't as bad as I expected, Chris. You spend most of the time, for obvious reasons, in your hotel room. But covering the event itself, it wasn't as bad as I thought. It was challenging. And I'm all about wearing my mask, doing exactly what we're supposed to do to keep everyone safe and healthy. But it was a little challenging probably to wear the mask for about 9 hours in a row from the time there was a non-televised undercard fight that I covered that your girl Jolene Mazzone matched. And, so by the time that it was a long card, obviously it was seven fights and broken into two segments. And by the time I got out of the arena, it was probably about 8.5-9 hours after I got there. But overall, I mean, it wasn't as bad as I was expecting or restrictive as I was expecting. You could get food at at all of the restaurants in Mohegan Sun, but you had to take it back to your room. You weren't allowed to eat at the restaurants. They're just trying to keep it as safe as possible. And they're doing a good job, I think, especially of keeping the fighters more important, obviously, than us and anyone else. But the fighters have been doing a good job adhering to the rules, I think, and there haven't been many positive tests recently. I think there's a variety of reasons for that. But overall, they're doing a nice job up there at Mohegan Sun, Showtime, and the PBC.
And I'm sure Jolene's...
I'm sorry, Chris.
No, I was going to say, I'm sure Jolene's matchup was a real barn burner. I'm sure that was a...
Well, her guy got knocked down. It was kind of a knockdown, but he got... He's the number one contender for Jermall Charlo's title. He's a he's a puncher, but he really hasn't fought the highest level of opposition, of course. But I think I want to say he's like 17-0 with 13 knockouts or 14 knockouts, something like that. And he came back to dominate his opponent, but he did get caught with a flash knockdown there in the first round. So yeah.
No, that's just my way of just taking a dig at Jolene.
Of course.
At all times, all availability, I want to take a dig at main events VP Jolene Mazzone. all right, let's jump right into some of the news of the week, Keith. Outside the ring, some big news. Deontay Wilder has elected not to work with Mark Breland anymore. Breland has been part of Wilder's team for a very long time, but most notably recently was the man in the seventh round of Wilder's fight against Tyson Fury that threw in the towel. Wilder, in the aftermath of that, was extremely upset about it. There were questions about whether or not he would retain Breland. Wilder publicly said he would. And now we have this turn of events, perhaps just months away from a third fight with Tyson Fury. So, Keith, what do we know about Deontay Wilder's decision to part ways with Mark Breland?
I think, Chris, that Deontay Wilder made up his mind to, quote unquote, fire Mark Breland that night. I don't think anything changed. I didn't believe for one second that press release that they sent out the following week. I think both of us were in Texas at that point for the Mikey Garcia, Jesse Vargas card. They sent out a press release later in that week, you know, kind of late at night, that Deontay Wilder had, you know, was going to keep Mark Breland. I didn't believe it. I just thought they were trying to smooth things over for public relations purposes, because Wilder was taking a lot of criticism that week in particular, because he had said some off the wall things, I guess, to me and to you and to other people. And I just think there was an avalanche of criticism coming Deontay Wilder's way. And that was a way to kind of stop some of it anyway, because, you know, there's been a lot of public backlash against Wilder because Mark Breland was obviously looking out for his well-being and ultimately did, I think, the right thing that night. But Wilder implicitly told him many, many times to never stop a fight. And Mark Breland did what he thought was the right thing, I think what a lot of other people think was the right thing. So I do understand why people have criticized Deontay Wilder for getting rid of him for that very reason. And then if you're Wilder, you look at it like, well, I told him not to do that how many times? And he technically, you know, although Breland is his co-trainer and has been with him his whole career, JD's is actually the head trainer, so he didn't really have the authority per se and the way that their team is constructed to do that. And JD's had told him not to do it, and he did it anyway. So Wilder kind of looked at it like he was you know, defying orders. But again, Mark Breland, who's a former welterweight champion, was a very good fighter in his time, a gold medalist, knows what it's like to be in there and to take punishment as a fighter, did what he thought was the right thing. And I think what most people would agree was the right thing. But to overall answer your question, Chris, I don't think anything necessarily changed over the last few months. I think this was a decision that was made a long time ago, and it just kind of came to light now because Deontay Wilder has kept a very low profile since the week after the fight.
Yeah, I think first, Keith, we're both in the camp of Mark Breland did the right thing. Mm-hmm. Like, Mark Breland saved Deontay Wilder from whatever amount of punishment he'd be able to take before Tyson Fury either put him on his back or the referee stepped in and stopped that fight. Like, this was... like, no rational person, even with Deontay Wilder's power, could have believed that he would have found a way to win. Like, it's just illogical to think that. I mean, Wilder's legs were gone. And as powerful as he is, you know, power is generated from that lower body. He wasn't going to be able to just arm punch Tyson Fury into a knockout. So Mark Breland did the right thing. What I'm curious about, what I think I need to know more about, is the timing of it all. Like, was this just announced... because it was a decent time to announce it, or had a decision been made or reached? I mean, has Mark Breland been working with Deontay Wilder over any period of time since that last fight? I mean, the last fight, it feels like it was last year, but it was February. I mean, that was, you know, 8 months ago, whatever it is. So a lot of time has passed. And now, I mean, I don't know when Wilder Fury 3 is actually going to take place. Probably not until early 2021, yeah. But we're inching towards it. And you're right. Jay Deese is still there. Jay Deese is the head trainer. But, you know, Mark Breland was a big piece of that puzzle. Are they going to replace him? Are they just going to go with Jay Deese, which, you know, they've done very early in Deontay's career? It does raise a lot of questions about who is going to be advising Deontay Wilder before easily the most important fight of his career.
Yeah, I do. Again, Chris, I do think that this decision was made. I haven't been given any indication that Mark Breland has been working with Deontay Wilder since he was able to return from the gym from his arm surgery. I don't think that he has. I think more so what it was is that Shelley Finkel, who's Deontay Wilder's co-manager, as you know, has a very close relationship with Mark Breland. He was his co-manager also, very close to Mark, wanted to give Mark every benefit of the doubt. And if I had to guess, I mean, Shelley has not told me this himself, but if I had to guess, Shelley probably tried to talk Deontay Wilder into not parting ways with Mark Breland, and ultimately he was unsuccessful. I don't think there was anything really magical to when this came out. I just think it was a matter of Dan Rafio, you know, we know a colleague for a long time, who now does some freelance work for our website. I think he just happened to speak to Shelley last week and ask him about that because Deontay was back in the gym. And I think that was the timing of it. I don't think there was anything more to it than that necessarily. But so, you know, Shelley told Dan what was going on and that the decision had been made. And so then it came out. So, yeah, I don't think it was anything more than that, really. And the interesting thing, as you said, Chris, is what is he going to do now? Is it just going to be JD's in the corner? Because he's obviously very comfortable with Jay, who's his, you know, was also his co-manager and been with him from the very, very beginning. But, you know, Floyd Mayweather has repeatedly offered to help him. Now, you put those two egos in the same room. I don't know which gym on earth is big enough to fit those two egos. But Floyd Mayweather, from a tactical perspective, certainly would be able to help his cause going into that third fight with Tyson Fury.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, theoretically, although we both know great fighters often don't make great trainers, and Floyd's style, obviously very different from what Deontay has stylistically. I mean, you'd think you'd try to find some kind of offensive coach, maybe, somebody, I don't know, I mean, I like Freddie Roach jumps to mind, but that's not going to happen. That doesn't make a lot of sense, at least logistically. Now we're into kind of opinion territory. Like, I think Deontay needs another voice. Like, I think JD's has done a remarkable job, you know, helping to build Deontay into the fighter he is today. But I don't think you just remove Mark Breland from the situation and don't replace him with anybody. And maybe they do have people in that camp or plan to bring people in that camp, but the clock's ticking. And if you're bringing in someone new, you know, a fighter's going to have to get used to the instructions of someone new. He's going to have to get used to the style of someone new. And I'm basing this all off, you know, last year, like reporting on Anthony Joshua and the two people he brought into his camp that added something to his game that he told me repeatedly. Like, it took me some time to kind of adapt to, you know, that style. So it just adds, Keith, a layer of intrigue to all this, right? Like, I mean, we're already curious what Deontay is going to look like in this third fight. Now it's Deontay minus Breland and maybe up somebody else. I mean, it just creates a new narrative to all this.
It really does, Chris. And I think ego is a big part of it in the sense that you don't want to, I think he would be cognizant of not bringing someone into the camp that is going to kind of consume what they're doing, because he doesn't want to look, if he wanted to fire JD's, he would have done it already. So he obviously still has faith in JD's. And if you bring someone in who's a big personality and he, you know, tries to, you know, just even unintentionally, he kind of becomes the leader of the team. It can cause problems that he doesn't need going into this fight, which, as you said, is an enormous fight for him. But they have kind of elevated Malik Scott's role. You know, that of course has a very close relationship with Deontay, has been in his camp. You know, obviously Deontay beat him way back when. He's been a sparring partner for Deontay and knows him very well. And he really respects Malik Scott. So, I mean, I don't know that he's bringing anything new to the table necessarily, because he's been involved the whole time. But he will play a more prominent role on Wilder's team. But it's going to be very interesting to see if they bring in someone else. And I would think, Chris, if they were going to bring in someone else, particularly someone high profile, I don't think Freddie Roach is ever a possibility, like you said, but someone of that magnitude, I think it would have been done already, because you want to have them while you have this extra time, and you don't know when the fight is even going to be scheduled. While you have this extra time, you would want to give them as much time in the gym, as many rounds as possible, for them to get used to working with each other before you really get toward crunch time of training camp. And they haven't done that as far as I know. So it kind of leads me to believe that they're going to go with JD's and Malik Scott and not bring in someone, you know, with a wealth of experience who has succeeded at the championship level with other fighters.
Yeah, and look, maybe they feel like, you know, their guy is what he is. He just has to do what he does better in this next fight, and they don't need another voice for that. That's certainly a reasonable position to take. It just, it's a roll of the dice, that's for sure, to lose a voice and a mind like a Mark Breland. All right, let's talk about my favorite subject. You were ringside, Keith, this past I heard that. You were ringside for Jermall Charlo's win over Sergey Derevyanchenko. Terrific performance by Charlo. A signature win for him at 160 pounds. Gives him some momentum going into his next fight. But what will that next fight be? Our old friend Eddie Hearn stole a crop-together photo that I had, put it on social media, and says, look, Charlo, Demetrius Andrade, is an easy fight to make. Keith, I have like a Charlo Andrade radar in my head. When somebody brings it up, I just notice it across the world. Is Eddie Hearn right? Is Charlo Andrade easy to make?
First and foremost, if this fight ever happens, we're going to have to put you in a rubber room the night of the fight. I mean, you won't even be able to think straight, I don't think. But I don't think it's an easy fight to make now for a variety of reasons. One, DAZN clearly is not looking to spend the type of money that it was spending before. So whoever you believe with the $7 million offer, whatever side you're on, just let's remove that. Not you personally. I just mean fans,
right,
and other media or whatever. Let's just remove that from the equation for now. That $7 million I would not think is going to be available for Jermall Charlo for that fight. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think so, because they're looking to significantly cut what they're paying the biggest star in the sport. They don't want to pay Gennady Golovkin necessarily what he thinks he's supposed to make for his next fight. So I wouldn't think that they would be looking to spend that type of money on Charlo Andrade, which is a good fight. It is a good fight. I would like to see it. It's I don't know necessarily it would be the most entertaining fight in terms of the way their styles would mesh, but it's a meaningful fight. It's a middleweight title unification fight. Both guys are undefeated. They've kind of been circling each other for the last few years, especially thanks to your help.
Obsession.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, if it's me and I'm DAZN and I'm looking to make a big fight that involves Jermall Charlo, and that might include working with Showtime, where you put the fight on pay-per-view and on DAZN, because they have expressed willingness to do that for Canelo Alvarez's previous fights to make it work financially. I don't know why fans necessarily, I know I'm getting off track here for a second, but I don't know why fans necessarily would pay $75, or in that case, probably a little more, $80, to watch something on pay-per-view that you could watch for $20 on a streaming service. But there is the belief, even within DAZN, that there are people who are trained to do that and will do it. So they would kind of partner in that case with Showtime, I think it would be Showtime, to make that fight and then try to make it work financially on both ends. But if I'm DAZN and I'm going to try to get involved in the Jermall Charlo business in whatever way I can, the fight that I'm looking to make is Canelo Alvarez and Jermall Charlo, not Jermall Charlo and Demetrius Andrade. Now, there's a million reasons why that probably won't happen. I'm just saying, ideally, that would be the way to go, assuming they can repair their relationship, which I think you and I both agree will probably happen. I think it will continue fighting on DAZN. Assuming that happens, I think, you know, Charlo Alvarez, or Alvarez Charlo, as it would be billed, is a much more intriguing fight now than it was 3 weeks ago. And I thought it was pretty intriguing then. But the way that he beat Sergey Derevyanchenko was pretty convincing. I would prefer to see him fight Canelo. And after the fight, Ronnie Shields told me, a couple minutes after the press conference, he said, look, we'll move up to 68 to fight Canelo. If he wants to fight at 75, which I don't think Canelo is going to do again, but even if he wanted to fight there, that wouldn't be wise in giving Charlo more of a size advantage, but we'll do whatever he wants to make the fight. That would be the fight that I would be trying to push. Now, of course, the biggest obstacle is they want him to fight Triple G the third time, which is the reason why they signed Triple G. And there are a million complications there. I'm just saying, ideally, that's the fight I would be trying to make, Alvarez Charlo, whether it's at 60 or 68, because that is the fight. I think, I'm not saying commercially it's a bigger fight than the third Triple G fight, but there are a lot of people who don't want to see Canelo fight Triple G the third time because they've already seen it twice. And now Canelo, it looks like there's more distance between Canelo and Golovkin than there once was, based on Golovkin's age, how he looked in the Derevyanchenko fight, a lot of other factors.
Yeah, you make some good points, although I'll be editing out any critique of Andrade Charlo as a barn burner of a fight. The issue I have is that even if you're right that, you know, there are plenty of people that don't want to see Canelo versus Golovkin 3, we both know, like, if DAZN can make that fight happen, they're going to do it. Like, that's it. And that would be likely ticketed for May of 2021. Mm-hmm. So if you're taking Canelo off the table till at least September of 2021, which would be the earliest he'd kind of be available for a Charlo fight, what does Charlo do in between? Like, are we just going to be satisfied with Chris Eubank as an opponent? And, like, Eubank's okay, but you know, you mentioned Ronnie Shields. Like, I was reading some comments from him recently where he's like talking about, you know, Eubank's interim title being elevated to full title, and they can fight for a unification fight for a title that nobody's actually won. Like, none of these titles actually were, you know, won in the ring against a recognized champ. Like, there's just some goofiness to it all. My biggest issue, my issue is not with Canelo Charlo. I'm on the same page. I think that's a big fight in 2021. I just don't see it happening until the fall. And in between then, if we're looking at maybe two Charlo fights, maybe most likely one, but maybe two, if we're looking at that many fights, like, I don't want to see him fight nobodies. I don't want to see him fight Chris Eubank. I don't care. Chris Eubank is fine, but Chris Eubank does not move the needle. And if they put that on Showtime, it's going to do a dreadful rating. It just is. Chris Eubank is not a known commodity in the U.S., and that does nothing for me. I don't know, to your point about the money, I don't know if that $7 million, X million, whatever number it was, is still on the table. I wouldn't look at the current landscape at DAZN as being indicative that it's definitely not. I think one thing they do want to do, and they're still motivated to do, are those Jose Ramirez, Maurice Hooker type fights, where if you've got Andrade here and you're obligated to pay him X amount of money when he gets in the ring, you know, goose it a little bit or a lot and, you know, get him in a big fight. And if he loses, you're kind of done with him. Like, you can, you know, move on or cut his rate, you know, at least dramatically. So I think there's probably a pretty significant financial offer still on the table if it's on DAZN. I don't know the interest that Showtime would have, what kind of guarantees they would make in a pay-per-view. And to your point, I'm not sure what kind of number that does on pay-per-view, even though the boxing purists would understand the level of fight that it is. But I don't want to go through 8 more months of Andrade versus whoever he's going to fight in the fall, and then maybe Liam Williams, and then Charlo versus Chris Eubank versus whatever mandatory that's out there on the WBC. I don't want to go through with it. Like, it just, none of it moves the needle. And if you've got these two guys that are undefeated middleweights with, you know, belts around their waist, everything possible should be done to pressure them to get into the ring. That includes saying that Chris Eubank versus Charlo is a whatever fight. I think that includes going after Andrade, you know, and making sure he makes it clear he can go over to Showtime pay-per-view and take that fight for the right money. I mean, this, to me, it's just like about public pressure. Just like keep applying it and applying it and applying it and hope that one day saner heads prevail and it actually happens.
Chris, I share a lot of your concerns. You know, I would prefer Charlo to fight someone other than Chris Eubank next. Chris Eubank Jr. is, you know, unfortunately, is probably going to be Charlo's next opponent, if I had to guess, because he was actually the front runner to fight Charlo, you know, but before I think they came together on this pay-per-view combo with both Charlos and everything, he was the front runner, I think, to fight. They fought on the same card back in December. Chris Eubank Jr. signed with Al Haymon and the PBC specifically to fight Charlo. So I think that fight will happen next. If I had to guess, and my best educated guess would be that he would fight, and obviously not on pay-per-view, but there are some components overseas that make sense. You know, Eubank is a popular fighter in the UK, and there would be some television money available there for him to fight against Charlo. So I do think that fight probably will be next for Charlo. And like you said, if who knows when Canelo is going to fight next, but just for argument's sake, let's say that he fights Golovkin a third time in May and he wins. Well, then he should be available to fight Charlo next. And then if Charlo is on the same schedule where maybe he fights in the spring sometime, then he would be available for that fight. And he continually says that he wants that fight. I don't think either one of them are quote unquote afraid of it, but in fairness to Charlo, he was the mandatory challenger for Canelo. And then they made up this kooky franchise designation, which was not transferable according to what they said and is now transferable in the Lomachenko-Lopez fight. So who the hell knows exactly, but Canelo could have fought Charlo if he wanted to and vice versa. You know, and I'm not saying that, you know, other fights that Charlo took, you know, were as appealing as the Canelo fight. They obviously were not, but that fight could have happened. I mean, it could have been mandated, you know, if the WBC wanted to do that, but here we are, you know, they still haven't fought, and who knows when Canelo is going to fight next, but he's going to fight, obviously he's going to fight Golovkin before he fights anyone else in a high profile fight.
Yeah. And look, in boxing, you don't have to earn anything, but I mean, to me, Andrade versus Charlo, like the winner of that fight earns Canelo, like he's earned it at whatever weight class he wants to fight at. I mean, they would be the most credible next opponent for it. There would be some buzz for it because of the win they were coming off. If they fought, say, in March and got a win and Canelo fights in May, you know, that's an easy one to make. I mean, obviously boxing doesn't go by logic ever, but
yeah,
this, it just, it's like, you know, too often it feels to me in a way that Charlo's trying to kind of backdoor his way into a Canelo fight. Like he gets a win over Derevchenko, then he takes maybe, I don't want to call Eubank an easy fight, cause I think Eubank's pretty good, but he takes an easier fight and then, you know, can kind of talk his way into a Canelo fight because Canelo doesn't have the options that maybe he once did.
Yeah. One thing I would say, Chris, is I don't think at this point Charlo needs to earn the Canelo fight. I think he did that on September 26th because Canelo, the other opponent that Derevchenko, as you well know, was considering fighting, and he actually picked the Charlo offer over the Canelo offer. But of course, he was going to fight Canelo. So if Canelo, if Derevchenko was an acceptable opponent for Canelo, then the guy who beat Derevchenko convincingly should be an acceptable opponent for Canelo. If the argument is that he hasn't, quote unquote.
Yeah, I get it. He's got good wins at 154. That's a good win at 160. Certainly is a marketable opponent. I will not stop banging the drum, though, Keith. I will not stop.
That is what this is all about. You don't want to hear anything contrary to Andrade happening, and you never will. So I get it. I get it.
People are like, I get it all the time on Twitter. Like, you just want Charlo over on DAZN. You could put that on, like, True TV pay-per-view. I don't give a shit. Like, just put it on hand. I don't care. Yeah. Like, I might not be able to physically be able to call a fight like that. I'd be so excited. Like, I might not.
That's what I said.
I might need to take a step back into press row again.
A rubber room next to the media room for Mannix on the night of Charlo Andre. But Chris, I'm with you though, in the sense that if that fight had to go to pay-per-view to make it work financially, I think they would be wise to do something like they did September 26th. Package his brother against a good opponent and do it that way and try to stack the undercard as best you can, because it's not as big commercially, Andre Charlo, as obviously as Charlo Canelo or Charlo Golovkin or whatever.
Right. A couple things here. Terrence Crawford, it looks like he's earmarked to fight Kell Brook. I'm a little surprised, Keith, that Kell Brook is going to like try to make 147 again. It seemed like those days ended after the Errol Spence fight and he moved up. I had an opportunity to, I mean, one of the issues that he had with Amir Khan was that Kell Brook didn't want to go all the way down to 147, but it seems like this is the fight that's going to happen. We are in a pandemic. Kell Brook is a name. What do you think of Kell Brook as an opponent for Terrence Crawford sometime in the next couple of months?
Yeah. You know, it is what it is. You know, I look, Kell Brook has only lost two times. I think, you know, he's obviously outside of his physical prime at this point, particularly with all the punishment that he took in the two fights that he lost to Gennady Golovkin and Errol Spence. You know, he took a hellacious beating against Golovkin, was very competitive in the fight against Spence before Spence broke him down, suffered those broken cheekbones on both sides of his face. Hasn't been in a quote unquote tough fight since then necessarily, but he's 34 years old and, you know, has a very good resume, obviously has a huge heart, fought Golovkin, have moved up to 160 to fight Golovkin. I don't think he has any chance at this point to beat this version of Terrence Crawford. I don't see that. But people will say it's his fault, and I understand it to some degree. You know, Crawford is not – none of the PBC guys are available for Crawford. Now, again, you can blame that on Crawford or blame that on PBC or whatever, but he's not fighting Sean Porter – you know, certainly not fighting Errol Spence. So they went for a name opponent who took the fight for a little less money than people probably would have expected it would cost, you know, based on the pandemic and him knowing that there are no other paydays out there for him except Amir Khan, as you mentioned. And I think as it relates to Amir Khan, Chris, that's all ego. He just didn't want to give in. Amir Khan wanted the fight at 147 and says that he's the A side. And Kell Brook said, you know, screw you. I'm not going to do what you say. We're not going to do it on your terms. If they would have fought at 148, 149, 150, I think the fight would have happened by now. But I think that's more what it was, that he just didn't want to concede to Amir Khan what Amir Khan was demanding for the fight to happen. And that's what else is there really for Kell Brook to do? I mean, if he's a 54 pounder, I certainly don't want to see him fight Jermell Charlo, and I'm sure you don't either. So who is he going to fight? I mean, what relevant fight is there for him besides moving down and fighting Terrence Crawford? And look, if he pulls off an upset, I mean, his career is revived, and he obviously gets another payday, and he's obviously another huge fight. But I don't know. I mean, at this point for Crawford, I don't know. I mean, what does it do for Crawford to beat Kell Brook?
Yeah, I mean, just say you've beaten the two British guys in your weight class and Kell Brook.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's not, there's not a lot of appeal to it. It's whatever to me. I guess on Brook, one thing that crossed my mind in the last month or so was, you know, if Patrick Teixeira didn't have to make his mandatory right away against Castaño, you know, could Eddie Hearn, you know, entice Golden Boy to make that matchup, you know, which is certainly a winnable fight for Kell Brook at 154, since Teixeira is not a stopper, but you know, that's not a major fight either. So it's whatever. And we're still on this kind of path with Terrence Crawford where, you know, when's that next big fight come and where does it come from? Yeah. I mean, do we have to wait until the winner of Josh Taylor versus Jose Ramirez, if that fighter moves up to 147 sometime in late 2021, I mean, is that the next big fight or is there a PBC opponent out there that'll emerge? I mean, we've been having the same conversation, it seems like, Keith, about Terrence Crawford for the better part of the last, you know, few years.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. I mean, the Taylor Ramirez winner makes a lot of sense because I think they both would want to move up to, you know, if you're the undisputed champion at 140, there's nothing left for you to do in that division, which is exactly what Terrence Crawford did when he moved up to welterweight and beat Jeff Horn. So that makes perfect sense. It's all in-house because Taylor is co-promoted by Top Rank. Ramirez is promoted by Top Rank, as is Crawford. So there would be some interest in that fight, I think, if you take the undisputed 140-pound champion, put him against the former undisputed 140-pound champion, that's a good fight. I mean, Crawford would be favored. But the other thing for people to remember, Chris, is that Terrence Crawford is now 33 years old. I mean, he's getting toward the back end of his, or he is in the back end of his physical prime. And, you know, some people have wondered whether his physical prime has been wasted over the last couple of years. Some of it his fault, some of it maybe Top Rank's fault, some of it not. But they want, you know, you would rather have seen him fight the best opponents he's going to fight when he was 30, not 35. So he's pretty preserved, though, I'll say that. I mean, it's not like he's been in some knockdown, drag-out slugfest. I mean, he's a good defensive fighter. He's a smart fighter. Seems to, as best as I can tell, you know, live a clean life outside of the ring. So, you know, doesn't want to wear a mask, I guess. So he doesn't believe that the pandemic is real. But beyond that, I think I think he's well preserved, though. I don't think he's like an old 33. So, but he is 33.
Yeah. I mean, it feels like there's a few guys that maybe like that. I mean, we were talking about Demetrius Andrade. He's in his early 30s now. Like, could we see his prime years wasted just toiling around because he can't get fights? And that's kind of the narrative of this generation where, like, nobody takes these, you know, I mean, not nobody. There are plenty of fighters. Errol Spence is doing it. You know, nobody takes super tough fights in their prime or else they don't get enough of those tough fights in their prime. And Crawford's kind of the standard bearer for that type of fighter, but there's more, like there's a handful more of them like Andrade that are in that mix. And that's unfortunate. That's one of myriad reasons, Keith, that we could go on and on about that. Why boxing is in kind of the position it finds itself in, you know, outside of the mainstream kind of looking in, but that's a whole nother podcast. That's a whole nother conversation. Before I let you go, Hall of Fame ballots came this week. And there are some years, Keith, when I wonder if I even should submit a ballot at all, because I don't really like any of the names on it. There are other years like this one where I'm wondering, you know, which highly qualified fighter is going to be on the outside looking in. For people that don't know how the Boxing Hall of Fame votes, members of the boxing writers like yourself, you and me, we get ballots, we vote, and you know, we vote for five, three get into Canastota in an award announcement that is announced in December. So this year, Keith, you've got Vladimir Klitschko, you've got Floyd Mayweather, you've got Miguel Cotto, you've got Andre Ward, you've got a whole bunch of guys that have been on for a little while. Like Ivan Calderon, I think, is a guy that deserves some serious consideration this time around. What do you make of this ballot? I mean, how tough is it going to, I probably want to hold on to who you're going to vote for, but how tough is it going to be for you to mail that in before the end of the month?
Yeah, no, it's really, it's interesting, Chris, because as you said, there are some years where the guys who, it used to be a 5-year waiting period, like with baseball and other sports, and now it's 3. So, this class is incredible. I mean, the guys, how do you, look, you can only vote for 5 guys, as you said. Well, out of the 5 guys who are new to the ballot who last fought in 2017, how are you not voting for Floyd Mayweather, Vladimir Klitschko, Andre Ward, Miguel Cotto, or James Toney? Those 5 guys are first ballot Hall of Famers. I mean, obviously there's a pecking order among those guys, but how would you not vote for the 5 guys that are new to the ballot? And then it's, like you said, there are guys left over that have not made it yet, who certainly warrant being in the Hall of Fame. Well, if you're going to vote for the 5 new guys on it, who you believe are first ballot Hall of Famers, you can't vote for any of the other guys. So it's going to be tough stuff. I mean, someone's going to get screwed. I mean, there's no two ways about it. But I'll tell you this, you know, the unfortunate thing for the Boxing Hall of Fame, which heavily relies on induction weekend to sustain itself, and obviously could not do that during the pandemic, they're going to have basically 2 ceremonies in 1 next year. That's going to be a hell of an event, because I would assume that Floyd Mayweather, Andre Ward, Vladimir Klitschko, pick whoever you want, and then take the class from the previous year and put it all together. That's going to be an enormous event and a big money maker for the Hall of Fame, which really needs that after having a year where you couldn't have people even go to the Hall of Fame and pay admission to go see it and miss the induction ceremony.
Yeah, and we're presumably going to get a Lou DiBella speech at the Hall of Fame.
I get a Lou DiBella speech 4 times a week.
Yeah. I only get it once, so you've got a few on me. I'm looking forward to Lou's, Frank Costanza airing of the grievances thing. He's going to go in there. He's going to look out into the crowd going, a lot of problems with you people out there. It is going to be tough. Like, I started to sketch out who I wanted to vote for. Not to delve too deep into it, but I'm going to give some pretty strong consideration to Calderon this time around. I feel like the little guys often get ignored. Calderon was such an accomplished guy, and during the early 2000s, he was not only winning, but he was in really exciting fights, statement fights. I think the smaller guys are getting a little bit more popular nowadays. Chocolatito played a big role in that, but Calderon was a monster in his day. He was really talented. So that might be the one guy that makes my ballot over some of the more established guys that are first or second year on that ballot. What do you think, before I end this, what do you think, the idea of staying, of cutting it from 5 years to 3 years? I don't love that because, I mean, lots of fighters come out of retirement after 3 years. I mean, like, would it shock anyone if Floyd fought one more time? Probably pretty surprising if Vladimir fought one more time, but I wouldn't rule it out. I think Andre's probably retired, but back of his head, maybe there's a huge fight he wants to take at some point. It's just, I don't love the idea of going 3 years over 5. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, first and foremost, I hope all 3 of those guys remain retired and don't fight again. Andre clearly is the youngest of the 3, but all have done, Floyd first, above all others, has done incredibly well financially, does not need to fight again. And Vladimir Klitschko, I think the same goes for him, has done very well with his money. As many other interests as well into his mid-40s, wouldn't want to see him fight. And Andre is younger, but I think a very smart guy and realizes, look, I made a lot of money. I've got a good gig here with ESPN. No reason to tempt fate again. So I hope we don't see those 3 guys fight. But I do agree with what you're saying in that fighters seemingly never retire. And even if it was 5 years, Chris, there's always the potential for, especially for a guy like Andre Ward, despite what I just said, but his age, he's not even anywhere near 40 years old yet. So he's, so it wouldn't stun me if he fought again, but he seems to be leaning in the other direction. So yeah, I don't love the 3-year thing. We would have been in the same, just for argument's sake, say these 5 guys that I mentioned that are new to the ballot earlier, if they all remain retired and don't fight again, we'd have the same selection problem 2 years from now that we're having now. But I would prefer it to be 5 years also. I'm with you on that.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be a hell of a class, no question, with the double class going in June. That's a must-attend weekend out in New York. for that type of event. Keith, always appreciate the time, man. Glad you're out of the quarantine in the Showtime bubble, and hopefully we'll see you at the next one real soon, man. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, my pleasure, Chris. I'm going right back to the actual bubble there in Las Vegas for Lopez Lomachenko.
There you go. That's a conversation for next week. I'm looking forward to that one, too.
Me too, man. Be well, Chris. I'll talk to you soon, bud.
Coming up next, 130-pound champion Leo Santa Cruz. All right, Leo Santa Cruz is here, 130-pound title holder. He'll end an 11-month layoff when he takes on Gervonta Davis on Showtime pay-per-view on October 31st. And Leo joins me here on the show. Leo, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great. I just got back from the gym, training went well. I feel great. I feel strong, great skill, everything. So we're just ready for the fight.
So how are you feeling about this fight? What's your excitement level for this fight compared to some of the other big fights you've had, whether it's Carl Frampton, Abner Mares? How up are you for this fight?
This is the most time I've been more excited, because it's my first pay-per-view, me headlining it, fighting a fighter like Tank Davis. He's a great fighter. The people wanted this fight, so I asked for this fight and I got it. I'm very excited for to go out there and show the world that I could compete against Tank Davis and that I could beat him.
You've been talking about Tank Davis for a while now. After the last couple of fights, you've been saying, I want to fight Tank. Why was he the guy that you were targeting so specifically?
Because, he's a great fighter. He's a great fighter. He has great power. And I think he's one of the best fighters out there, that I could prove myself and that I could show the world that I'm not scared of nobody. People were saying that I'm scared to fight, big opponents, big challenges. And I think Gervonta Davis is the biggest challenge out there. He's a bigger name than all of the people that other people wanted me to fight. So, who better than Gervonta Davis to prove other people wrong that I'm here to fight the best?
When he made the jump up to 135 pounds last year, did you think that, okay, it's probably not going to happen?
Yeah, that's what I did. When he moved up to 135, I was like, I don't think he's going to make 130 no more. So I think that fight is going to, go out the window. But then he said that he could come down in weight. And I was like, well, if he could come down in weight, let's make this fight. And he did.
He says he's going to come down in weight. That's been something of a problem for Tank, as you know, in the past. Sure are you that he's going to make 130 pounds?
Well, I'm not 100% sure, but, it shows in his work. It looks like he's working hard. It looks like he's in shape already. His body, he doesn't look that fat no more. And he started a camp, I think it was maybe 12 weeks before he started. Like, he has a 6-week or 8-week camp.
So there are obviously financial penalties if he doesn't make that weight, but you're a guy that's just starting out at 130 pounds. How comfortable would you be if he didn't make weight?
The truth, I'm not going to be comfortable. I won this fight, and just not for a pound or 2 pounds overweight. I'm not going to, throw the fight away. This is a big fight, and if he comes overweight, I'm going to be disappointed, but I'm still going to fight. I'm going to go out there. And I know there's advantages on his side if he doesn't make weight. But I'm still, I'm a warrior. No matter what, I'm going to take the fight and just go out and give the fans a great fight.
So take me back, Leo, to last November. I was ringside for your win over Miguel Flores. But I think everyone agreed, yourself included, that it was not your best performance. What did you think of the way you fought that night?
The last fight, 1 week before the fight, I got a little bit sick. I got the fever for 3 days. I really couldn't, I didn't feel as strong. When I was training, before, I felt strong. I was like, I feel really good. I'm going to go out there and try to do a great fight, look strong. But, like I said, 5 week, I was still sick. And I was worried that I wasn't going to be at my best. And, it did happen. When I went up there, I didn't feel as strong as I was feeling, and it wasn't my day that day.
So why go right into a fight with one of the best in the division? Why not have one more fight at 130 to get truly comfortable? Or do you feel like you're truly comfortable already at 130?
I think I could have gotten one more fight, but people were going to say that why are you taking another tuna fight? You say you're going to fight the best and you keep on not fighting the best. So I was like, I'll just go straight for, you know, with Gervonta Davis. So that way people won't be saying that I'm cherry picking, that, you know, I keep on taking tuna fights. So I say, I'm going to go straight away. Hopefully for this fight, I do feel 100% strong and I go out there and look my best.
So in that one fight, did you feel any difference in your speed and power with that extra 4 pounds?
Yeah, I felt a little bit stronger. Like I said, I was feeling a little stronger. And my sparring partners were saying that I was feeling stronger. But like I said, I think when I was sick, that took a little bit of my power and I couldn't showcase my 100% what I've been working on and everything. But right now, I do feel 100%, you know, strong. And my sparring partners say that I do feel a lot stronger and that, you know, I'm looking at my best I have ever been before.
So as you go into this fight, having the experience of one fight at 130, do you feel, have you had to make any changes in your training as you prepare for this fight?
I just been in a little bit more, you know, I've been staying at 140 for a while. I could have been at like 132, 133 already right now, but my brothers tell me to stay like around 140, 142. That way I won't give too much weight advantage and I'm eating good steaks and everything. So I feel good. I feel strong and I feel great in the sparring. In my training camp.
Davis, as we know, is a powerful guy, especially at 130 yes. pounds. What's the key to you to countering that kind of power?
You know, I just got to go out there and be smart, really smart. I got to fight a perfect fight, not try to exchange power punches with him, be on the outside, keep him outside with the jab, and the right, and just be really, you know, counter punch him, wait for him to throw the punches, and then go after, you know, when I see he gasses out and stuff like that, I'm going to go after him and hopefully, you know, that's where we take an advantage.
Have you been able to have as close to a normal training camp as you would with everything that's going on in the world?
Yeah, no, it's been a little bit hard. But I'm still training, you know, I'm very, you know, focused. I'm doing everything I have to do to come out for this fight and look my best. I'm going to strength conditioning coach, my strength conditioning coach Andy Aguilar, and I've been in the gym with my dad, and you know, he's been back and forth and we're still doing everything we had to do.
How's your dad doing these days?
My dad's doing, you know, good. There's some days, bad days, that he has a lot of pain and stuff, but he's always in the gym. Today was one of those days that he felt a little bit sick, so he didn't go to the gym, but he's still there with me all the time and he's calling me, telling me that to work hard on the things he wants me to work on, and that's what I do.
You expect him to be in your corner on fight night?
Yes, of course. You know, I expect him to be in my corner fight night. And he wants to go. He said, I got to be there, and I want him there. So he's going to be there.
This is going to be a fight that there actually will be fans in attendance. Maybe the first fight that has fans in attendance. How do you feel about that?
I feel great. You know, this is what I wanted. I wanted to fight with fans because, you know, he has the feeling that fighting there with no fans, no cheers, no screams that, you know, bring that extra out of you. It's just, no, it sucks. But knowing that I'm going to fight with fans is a great relief. I'm more motivated. I just want to go out there and give the fans a great show, and hopefully I get the win.
Have you watched any of the fights, you know, on TV or otherwise that haven't had fans with them?
Yeah, I have. I have watched fights, and yes, no, it looks weird. It looks, you know, like, no action because there's no fans screaming and stuff. It feels like you're just right there sparring, or you know, it's like a light sparring.
Yeah, it was really weird watching Jose Zepeda versus Ivan Baranchuk with eight knockdowns, and yep. nobody in the crowd to respond to it. Wild.
Yeah, I know. I can imagine, man. It was a great fight. If it would have been with fans, it would have been a great atmosphere, and it would have been great.
And just the last question for you, Leo. This is a fight, you know, a contestant at 130 pounds. Do you believe the winner of this fight should be considered number one at 130 pounds?
Yes, of course. I think that the winner of this fight should be considered the, you know, number one in the 130 pounds, and also should be considered in the top 10 pounds for pounds, one of the best. Because, you know, I'm a 4-division world champion. Gervonta Davis, a 3-time world champion. He's a great fighter, so I think the winner of this fight should be considered right there and put right there in the top 10.
It sounds like some of the criticism of you in the last couple of years, where people have said, you know, how many more tune-up fights are you going to take? Has that bothered you? Has that affected you?
Yeah, it does, you know, because I'm here to please the fans. You know, I want to fight for the, I fight for the fans. I'm here thanks to them. So I want to please them. You know, I ask for the fights they want me to fight, but yes, the promoters, they don't get to an agreement and make those fights. But I now that I ask for Gervonta Davis, they did, you know, make it. And I'm just, you know, happy that they gave me this fight and I could prove the fans and show them that I'm here to fight the best.
Should be a great fight. Leo Santa Cruz, Gervonta Davis, Showtime pay-per-view, October 31st. Leo, good luck, man. Good luck in training and looking forward to fight night.
No, thank you, Chris. Have a great day and thank you for everything.
You got it. All right, that's it for this week's episode. My thanks to my guests. As always, subscribe to the podcast over at Apple Podcasts. Rate, review, you know I appreciate it, and I'll see you next week.